Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Head to patreon.com/chasingEarhart to join the chase and become a patron today. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 80 years later, all over the world, lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
Years ago, the world's most famous aviatrix was missing over the Pacific. Amelia Earhart, on a globe-girdling flight with navigator Fred Noonan, took off for a hop over trackless ocean wastes and was never heard from again. On the chance that she might be safe on then some remote island, an intensive air-sea search got underway immediately, but not even wreckage was ever found. Many and varied have been the theories on the disappearance, such as the possibility she wandered to the island of Truk, then being secretly fortified by the Japanese, and was executed to keep those plans secret. For a quarter century, the world has wondered.
Many hypothetical explanations of the disappearance and demise of Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan and the Lockheed Electra aircraft with which she hoped to circumnavigate the globe have been proposed. This is another, very similar to some others, but different in that it answers one important question. How did the radio broadcast from the Phoenix Islands originate without more evidence of the Electra crash on the islands of the region? And how did the flyers and aircraft completely disappear? On episode 29 of the podcast, we sit down with radar expert and project guest Tom Maxwell to discuss Amelia and Fred's world flight, what he believes happened on the morning of July 2nd, and whether or not Arona Island has been hiding the holy grail of aviation for the past 80 years. With me now, joining me via Zoom from Florida, is Tom Maxwell. He has a very interesting website and an even more interesting hypothesis that he's been working for quite some time. Tom, thank you so much for sitting in on the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me on, Chris.
Now, Tom, you've heard the shows. You know how this process works. Let's get into it. Can you tell everybody a little bit about your education and your professional background, please?
Well, I'm not a college grad, just high school and some college. I've worked in radar and computers, the biggest part of my career. It's all technical stuff. I'm pretty much the ordinary kind of an average guy, I guess, in that respect. I don't have any special credentials except experience.
And I think a lot of people would argue that experience is very important when it comes to this case in particular. But can you talk a little bit about how Amelia Earhart came into your life professionally?
Well, it was 1972 at Canton Island in the Phoenix Islands. I was a young radar technician back then, and it was a item of discussion. There was quite a bit of talk about it at the time. Garner's book was just out, I think, a few years earlier. I'm not exactly sure the time frame, but the old timers there would bring up from time to time the Pellegrino flight that landed at Canton in 1967. That was 5 years earlier, but that was my first encounter with the mystery. After I left Kwajalein, after I left Canton, I worked on Kwajalein for a number of years. So I got to visit Kwajalein and Roy Namor at that time. And there was, I didn't have specific information from local people at that time, but again, it was an item of conversation. I didn't really get that interested in the mystery itself until pretty late, till about 2002. I was approaching retirement, and I got interested through the Tiger site. I started viewing the internet and became more and more interested in that aspect of the mystery is, what are other people doing right now, and learning more that way.
Now, Tom, as you and I know, there's several different groups working varying hypotheses regarding Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, but you have something a little bit different than most folks, and you have a little bit of a twist that's different than most folks. Can you tell everybody exactly what your hypothesis is and what you believe happened?
Yes, well, it's very similar to some existing hypothesis. Amelia and Fred, I think, arrived in the area of Howland. They didn't have any homing beacon to help them out. After searching for a period of time, an hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever it was, they simply, because they couldn't communicate, they simply abandoned the effort and flew south into the Phoenix Islands. Fred, being a navigator and up to date on everything solar, he knew that just 3 weeks earlier, the Mitchell, Samuel Mitchell and the National Geographic Expedition, Solar Expedition, had been on Canton. So I theorize think that he thought maybe there would be help there. So, and the odds of finding these eight islands, which are all larger than tiny Howland, gave him a better chance. And they did. They flew down that line, and they encountered, at that time it was called Hull Island. They encountered Hull, today we call it Orona, and they performed a safe, soft water crash landing there in the lagoon at Howland, or I'm sorry, at Orona. The plane would have remained afloat. It was hung up on a coral tower. Those lagoons are full of towers of coral growth, and either a wing or the tail or something, and was partially supported by that, and would have remained afloat indefinitely. But my theory goes on to say, to speculate, that Japanese pirates, I call them pirates, they were members of a Japanese army unit who had been on neighboring Gardner Island, listening in on the activities at Canton. Anyhow, this pirate group sank or scuttled the aircraft and the raft, and they took Amelia and Fred as captives. The whole idea at the time, I don't know that they knew to do this, or but they did it anyhow, and after they scuttled the aircraft and the raft, they took Amelia and Fred either by boat somehow back to the Marshall Islands. And this was, they had to do it, had to do this either by submarine or by some, somehow they got through the naval search that was going on at the time, undetected. And there at Kwajalein, they were paraded about as spies, and they made a very definite effort to let lots of local Marshallese know that they had two American spies in captivity. And from there, they went on to remain prisoners until their deaths. They weren't, as I'm just speculating now, we're getting ahead of ourselves a long way, but they weren't mistreated, they weren't tortured, and they weren't executed. They were just victims of the war, like many people. They eventually she succumbed to infections, You know, she had that lifelong problem with sinusitis, and it got out of hand, and that's what, without antibiotics, that's what finally killed her. And they didn't want that to happen. They had every reason to keep her alive. But this whole I theorize this whole plot was a hoax by the Japanese Army to move the Japanese Navy into a more offensive posture or philosophy. The person they were trying to impact the most was Admiral Yamamoto. He was a leader. They knew they had to have him in order to maintain a powerful Navy, because he was much beloved by his sailors. But at the same time, he was an ardent believer in, let's not get involved with a war with the U.S. He had studied and traveled in the U.S., and he knew that the U.S. could float in the long term, could float a lot more steel than Japan. And even though he felt his Navy and his sailors were superior, he knew that he would lose it in the long term. But this was a kind of another ploy. There's lots of pressures on the Navy to go to an offensive posture. And eventually that culminated in the Pearl Harbor attack plan. So she was a very, by my theory, a very fundamental part of it, not the complete part, but part of the plan to change the Japanese Navy's modus operandi from a defensive kind of philosophy to a strategically offensive.
Okay, so there's a lot of meat on that bone. So what we're going to do is let's back up a little bit and talk about the island itself. Can you give everyone listening out there a little history on Arona, the island?
Well, with the exception of ancient Polynesians, the island is never been populated to any extent. And there have been attempts in recent history to colonize the thing, but they never have worked out. But during this period, 1937, there was a coconut plantation, and there were people on Arona. And this, of course, is the biggest criticism of this theory, is that these people would know that if a plane had landed there. Well, that's a debatable question, but there's enough wiggle room there to say that they weren't aware that it landed, and that the Japanese listening post on Nikumaroro was in fact aware that they were there, sailed over there and captured them, and escaped without being detected. On the other hand, if the coconut workers were aware that the Japanese were there, or they had direct information about where Amelia and the plane were, then they could have been coerced by the Japanese pirates to remain silent. And if you'll recall, it was a week after the disappearance that the Navy's Lieutenant Lambert landed on the lagoon, and talked to the foreman there, the supervisor, John Jones. Mr. Jones told them, of course, that he had no information, didn't even know who Amelia Earhart was, or had no information. But it was a curious conversation, because apparently is quite brief. And Mr. Jones never asked Lieutenant Lambert, I mean, what can I do if I find something? You know, how can I contact you? I thought that was kind of an unusual part of the mystery.
Now, according to the research that I've done, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Arona's lagoons are approximately 15 to 20 meters deep at their deepest, which is equivalent to anywhere between 49 and 66 feet. If the Electra is, in fact, somewhere in this lagoon, that would mean that it's not only possible, but it's probable that a dive team could get eyes on it and either rule it out or confirm it indefinitely. What would it take for that to happen?
In 2008, I did in fact find what I think is the aircraft, and documented that with the Google Earth image that we're going to be looking at here in a moment. And yes, it would be to go to that location would be very easy and low cost compared to some of the costs involved in other searches, you know, like the deep water search is a very, very expensive operation. So this could be done, you know, relatively cheaply compared to the other methods, you know, other search areas. So yes, you know, I estimate the depth is about 35 feet. I had some, as a novice scuba diver at Canton, with what the depths of these lagoons are. And yeah, about 35 feet is what I guess. And yes, you're right. There are some deeper areas, but just looking at the image, it looks like it's about 35 feet. Since 2008, I have been, you know, this is when I didn't do very much with the rest of the theory or the rest of the hypothesis until about 2012 or 2014, somewhere in that area. But so the first thing I did was I notified the PIPA people, the Phoenix Islands Protected Area Administrators. Those folks are charged with taking care of the administrating the protected area. That was in about 2009, 2010, something like that. Later on, I contacted Tiger and suggested, you know, that they incorporate this into their plans. And contacted many, many others, of course. But so far, no one has really shown a definitive interest in it.
So what has that done for you personally in sort of your quest to do the research on Arona and try to prove definitively that the plane is in fact in Arona, or should at least be looked at and included and not just automatically dismissed? Has that done any kind of damage to your morale as far as the case that you're working in your hypothesis?
It hasn't gone ahead in any respect. The AE mystery is just a very funny thing. It's kind of like religion or politics. Once you're educated in the orthodoxy or the dogma, it becomes very difficult to change people's minds. To, you know, it would be very difficult for a crash and sink person to move to Gardner Island. But the when we review the image, people just knowledgeable people about the mystery don't want to change their ideas, and it really hasn't had any impact on them.
So explain to me how you feel the plane ended up at Arona and how they got to Arona. Was this a shot in the dark, or was this a plan B? What happened here? Was this something that they just kind of lucked out and kind of happened upon when they realized they couldn't get to Howland?
It was a shot in the dark. I really think that Fred may have been looking for Canton. He knew it was a large enough that, you know, that they could, you know, they didn't have a definitive airstrip, but he knew it was big. And he thought there might still be support help there from the expedition, the solar expedition. But anyhow, in the best case, there's eight of those islands. And if you went down there and you had an hour's worth of fuel and you flew a box search and you knew you were kind of in the area, you would have a much better opportunity to find one of those islands than if you continued to search for tiny Howland. Three of the islands, Canton, Gardner, and Arona, and maybe a few of the others, have large enough palm trees that it would be more visible, you know what I mean? Plus the wide swath of white surf, like, you know, Arona is like 5.5 miles from one end to the other. And that white streak, you can see that for, I would think, at altitude, you know, on a good day, a minimum of 15, perhaps even 20 miles. So you've got a good chance of hitting one of these islands. And I think it was the right decision. And it would have worked had it not been for the Japanese capture angle. So here's what's important about this whole scenario. Orona is not new. There have been other hypotheses that originate there. It was Gervis in 1970 and Donahue in 1987 who pinpointed Orona as the place to look. But both of those authors, their hypotheses spun off in tangents that by logic said there'd have to be many, many witnesses to this. And neither one of them, the Gervis Kloss, that went on for several years. Both are, Gervis, his hypothesis was a Japanese capture, while Donahue's was it's called the British connection, that she was held under house arrest, or not house arrest, but house protection, I guess you'd call it, by the U.S. Navy. So both of them were just too far out for most people to accept. Anyhow, both of those authors somehow, somewhere got wind of that island as being one of the places to look. Exactly how, we don't know. Donahue gives us a little bit of a hint. Mr. Jones, John Jones, in his later years, he lived in American Samoa near Pago Pago, and was a frequent visitor because he was a military, guy for the Brits. He was in their service, and he could come on to the naval base there, Tutuila, and participate. And so Donahue kind of says, I'm not reading it right, but he doesn't come out and say exactly where he found this out. He just kind of puts all these facts together, and it really is a tangled fact-laden book if you've ever read it. But somehow they got the information. I think it came from Jones. And this John Jones is frequently confused with the John Jones of the New Zealand Coast Watchers, who was captured by the Japanese in the Gilberts and imprisoned for the biggest part of the war. He spent his later years getting a memorial dedicated and built and dedicated to the Coast Watchers who were executed in the Gilberts, by this Japanese pirates, if that's a good term. And it's very, very similar to the murders at Wake Island, the American murders at Wake Island. That was this unit's MO, is let's not leave any witnesses. I believe that if he was coerced and was the John Jones on Hull, if he was coerced, he very possibly could have, he knew later on in the war years, he knew that, you didn't fool around with these people because they could, you know, he didn't know if they were going to invade Pearl Harbor or Pago Pago. You know, he didn't know. So it was a very dangerous time in the Asia Pacific for everyone. So it's not outrageous to think that they could do that. Because if you'll recall history, 1937 was the year that all hell broke loose in Asia. Most of that is supposition, of course. It's not unreasonable to think that they would be fearful, you know, for their families. John Jones did have a family on Orona. I don't know that they were there on July the 2nd, but, you know, he did have a family in the area. You know, if he had been threatened or coerced, he just might keep his mouth shut.
Now let's move on to the landing itself. You've speculated and theorized that the Electra could have made the approach and potentially made a smooth water crash landing. Can you talk a little bit about that term and what you mean by that?
Okay, here's Orona. Amelia's plane is at the end of the arrowhead, and it's just absolutely beautiful tropical isle, you can see. The red line here shown is the 157 rum line. If they approached from the north after searching for Allen, they came over and landed directly into the wind, and the crash water landing is right here. So at the end of the yellow line, that's where the aircraft is again. The plantation, the coconut workers were over here on this side, and this distance from where they would be working to where they landed, that's about 4 miles. And where the aircraft turned is maybe 2 miles. So if an aircraft came in there at low power, at low elevation, these folks over here could perhaps never even hear it, never even be aware, because the wind is blowing this way. All this pounding surf noise is, you know, conceals most everything. In this image, this is another version of the image. The reason I like this one, it's kind of hard to see, I know, but you can see the aircraft here. X is right near the nose. And the raft is here. And I like this one because you can see the oval nature of the raft. And I'll get to why that raft looks so dark, why it's black like that. So a lot of people argue that this is just light and shadow. And you have to ask yourself, why would Mother Nature pick this spot in the millions of square miles of water to do this, to create this light and shadow? Only 400 miles from her destination. The Anne Pellegrino flight proved to me many years ago that, you know, it could fly. She could have had the capability to fly to the Phoenix Islands. Same image over and over again, the 2000 image. This is all subjective on my part, of course. You mean, you have to study this yourself to convince yourself, yay or nay. There's the right engine. There's the nose, left engine, the wing, the cabin, and the tail. All of those, when you look at that setup, that says that's very similar to the L10E. The reason the raft is really dark is because it was an orange or red or international orange, yellow raft. And that's the colors that are absorbed first by the water. And that's why it looks black. All of those yellow or orange colors are quickly absorbed. And it's oval, it's an oval shape. I've done two ways to analyze this. The one I used first was the refractive index of water and using the Google Earth tape measure to measure these distances from nose to tail. And all those work out. If you measure this with Google Earth, you'll get a value of 52 feet nose to tail. Divide that by 1.33, the refractive index of water, and that comes out to very close to 38 feet, 10 inches, the same length as the L10E. Same thing when you measure between the hubs, the propeller hubs of the engines, and from the engine hubs to the nose, and from the engine hubs to the center of the vertical stabilizer. All of these measurements come out right. That's one method. The other method is to take, I call it a symmetry analysis. This is taken from 75 feet. And you can see the left engine here. There's the windscreen. There's the nose. There's where the cabin door is. And there's the left vertical stabilizer. Then over here on the extreme right in this image here, this is the left wingtip. And you can see a blue hemisphere and this curve. That is a reflection of the sunlight from the underside of the wing. Sunlight comes down, strikes the sand. And we can't see the wings because they're covered with sand. I'll get into why we can see this. We see this because it's reflected or spectral light. And it's strong enough, spectral light, like the glare that we see in the headlights of a vehicle on a rainy night onto the pavement or off of a lake, or, you know, it's glint or glare, very intense, can be tens to hundreds of times as powerful as normal diffuse light. So that's why we're seeing it can get through the marine growth and illuminate the rounded surfaces of the aircraft. We can see that the main cabin here, there's the top, the rounded surface of the cowlings and the nose and the stabilizer. You can't see the flat wing because it's covered by sand. It's too thick. You know, there's no light can get in or out. But anyhow, this light hits the sand, bounces up, hits the bottom of the wing. There's no growth there because in the ocean or in if they don't have sunlight, the marine growth can't grow. I mean, corals can't grow, algae can't grow, nothing can grow when you don't have sunlight. So then it's bounced back and then up to the satellite above. All the combinations of circumstance that are required is very, very rare. The analogy I like to make is if there's a hunter on a hillside with a pocket mirror and he's shining it in one direction, what are the odds if you take a picture that you're going to see that mirror? Not very good. You can move to maybe 100 different locations and eventually you might get that reflection from the pocket mirror. So that's what happened. Had a very quiet sea, clear water, and the reflection from the sun, the angle between the sun, the plane, and the satellite camera just right to get this reflection. So the blue color, again, of the wingtip shadow is the result of absorption of the red and blue components. You get, just like everything else, blue.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit because I want to talk about the raft. And what I want to do is I want to read something directly from your site, and then we can discuss it long form. Quote, "The life raft was readied well in advance, as they could detect the slow slip of the plane down the coral head by the ever-decreasing dry area on the wing. As they prepared the raft, a small boat appeared, coming from the layside, against the backdrop of a thin green line of coconut palms. Both Amelia and Fred recognized that the people in the boat were not South Pacific Islanders, but rather Japanese sailors. Without expressing their purpose, the men in the boat seemed merely to observe and remain silent. As Amelia could speak and understand Japanese, she grew fearful of their intentions. No blankets, first aid, or water presented. Nothing in the boat to indicate rescue. She demanded a separate boat be provided from shore. Knowing they understood, she waved them away with the revolver she carried on the flight. The boat returned in the late afternoon. Each sailor aboard carried a rifle. Their gestures, with hands over heads, was clear. Surrender. Amelia didn't want the flying laboratory to fall under the control of a foreign power, so she fired a dutiful pistol shot across the bow of the small craft. The Japanese pirates peppered the aircraft with rifle fire. Fred and Amelia reluctantly tossed the revolver in the lagoon. Later restrained in the small boat with A.E.'s briefcase and Fred's charts, the navigation gear between them, the flyers watched as a sailor scuttled the L-10E aircraft and the rubber life raft. Knowing a sea and air search was in progress for the Americans, the Japanese pirates knew the craft must be hidden from view immediately." Now, that's a bold and detailed statement and a detailed account, and I'm assuming that it's speculative on your part. But can you discuss this particular scenario, and also can you talk a little bit about the raft in detail?
It's speculation on my part, the explicit detail. You have to remember, Amelia was a very strong-willed person, and I don't think that she would stand by idly if this scenario were to play out. So first you have to believe that the scenario like this could happen, and then you have to think, well, what would she do? More than likely, she would do something like this. Maybe not this, maybe that's a little dramatic, but it's not out of the question. There's been discussions, you know, was the raft even on the aircraft? And as far as we know from the earliest publications in the newspapers, all of her support staff, including her husband, said that she did have a raft. The other, I talked about using the water index of refraction to measure and calculate the various lengths. The other method I used was called, I call it symmetry. And I identified these seven definitive points, okay? A, B, C, D, the tail, E, and F, the two engines. Then I made these measurements with Google Earth. These 7 points allow 21 lines to be drawn. And those 21 lines allow 210 comparisons, if you're familiar with that. So a similar thing was done with the overhead sketch of the L10E. The same points, except with a great, with more accuracy, because you've got a sketch of drawing. Here, the exacting locations, those 210 comparisons, because now we know scale is not important because we're comparing dimensionless ratios. The ratio of AF divided by FB or whatever, there's 210 of those. And when you do the similar thing with the drawing, they're always in agreement within on average, about 5%. Some are much larger. So there's some that go up to 12%. But that's because the image is not, the aircraft is not setting on the lagoon floor as it would the floor of an aircraft hangar. It's not level. It's tilted slightly. Both the wing and tail are, they're not absolutely level. So that's why the error is. But those 210 ratio comparisons say that it is an L10E. We did the same thing with the B-25. One of the aspects of this is that there was a missing B-25 in World War II that flew on a flight from Canton to Tutu Ilya. The L10E and the B-25 both have twin tails. They're twin engine twin tails. We can see that the line AB passes directly through the engine propeller hub. It passes directly through the hub. And on the B-25, that line passes way out in front of the engines. So it's not a B-25. That was a question that came up.
Okay, let's talk about Coral. So if this Electra is indeed in Arona, what types of effects might Coral and the underwater environment in Arona have on a plane like this 80 years later?
It very obviously it's clustered. The surface is going to be covered with some coral, I would think. If you're familiar with the Kaneohe Bay PBY that University of Hawaii did, I think about 4 years ago, that airframe just absolutely covered with, encrusted with coral, not big coral growth, but small coral. But my point is that the photon is an extremely small piece of matter or whatever you want to call it, and it a piece of light, and it can get through on a brilliant sunlit day, get through and out in order to be seen. The other, in addition to the it's just light and shadow argument, the other argument is that this image does not show up on other photographs or other satellite images of Arona. And that is because those are made with diffuse light. You'll notice that those images are very dark. You don't have that reflected light to work with. But yes, coral and marine growth are going to cover it. But to what extent? Obviously enough that you can't see it in under normal lighting conditions.
Is it of your opinion that the plane would be intact, or do you think it would be in pieces?
It's intact, yeah. Yeah, it's all together.
You touched on it earlier, one of the arguments against the hypothesis, that the images are not light and shadow, and that they are, in fact, the remnants of the L10E. Now, can you discuss the reasons why you believe it's not, in fact, a light and shadow effect, and it is the body of the L10E Electra?
Well, again, why would Mother Nature affect this in the Arona Lagoon when it is it's in the area of where we would want to search? It's not off the coast of Saudi Arabia or anywhere else. I mean, if it's light and shadow can create this absolute replication, that if you want to look at a random pattern and see something and you do so long enough, you can see something. But other people have looked at this, and other people, a very few, and they have said, yes, that is an airframe of some sort. Is it a 10E? I got one person to agree with me. Why would Mother Nature do that?
Okay, so let's switch gears here a little bit and talk about something that I find particularly interesting, and I just wanted to ask you this question really point blank and see what you thought of it. Is there a Pratt & Whitney R1340 engine buried somewhere on Canton Island?
I never heard of such a thing for the 3 years I was there. Now, I know there's a Canton Island story about an engine being brought back, but if it was, no one there when I was there knew anything about it.
In your opinion, after all the research you've done and after all the time you've put into this, can you tell me what happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan?
I think Fred probably died of simple infections after he got into the after they took him to the Marshall Islands. There are some very, very powerful Staphylococcus bacteria in the tropics. So I think he had an injury. I think he got infected. There's nothing they could do for him. They didn't have the antibiotics. I have firsthand experience with that. And for people that arrive in the islands with they're brand new, you know, they fly in an airplane. They're very susceptible to serious bacterial infections. So that's what I think happened to Fred. I don't think he was executed or anything else. And Amelia, I think she was kept on Roy Moore for about 4 years. After she was kind of protected, she was protected there by the Navy, by Admiral Yamamoto. That was part of his deal with Tojo, was that he would turn his Navy to the offensive. But he needed some insurance, you know, hopefully, if they returned a famed heroic aviator that maybe he could get, you know, help somebody out. So anyway, he kept her there in relative comfort. It may have been a restful 4 years for her. I think she was shuttled back and forth for mock kangaroo type trials in the Marianas and Saipan. And then eventually after Midway, when Yamamoto's influence waned, he just didn't have the influence with the military that he used to. And then certainly after he died, the Japanese army took control of her captivity and moved her permanently to Saipan. By that time, things were getting pretty desperate through all the islands. Food and medical supplies and nutrition was a problem. And I think she simply succumbed to a bout of infection.
Tom, 2018 marks the 81st anniversary coming up of the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. Now, this seems to be a case that just has a stranglehold on the general public and all the people that are involved in the disappearance case itself in the research phase. But I want to ask you what you believe to be the reason for that. Why do you think the world is continue to be fascinated with Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, the disappearance case, and their lives, really?
Well, Amelia was, she was the Sally Ride of her era. She was a doer. I mean, she probably wasn't the most skilled pilot, but she was ready to set out and set new goals. Nobody could figure out why Amelia just wanted to talk on the telephone or on the radio. Didn't know how to do Morse code, because there's no airline pilots use Morse code today. Everybody talks, and she knew that was a capability that needed to be what we call upgraded to reality. So that was the kind of attitude she had. She was a doer, and she pressed the limit of what could be done. She was on the boundary of what was new, what lay ahead.
If she were alive today, what do you think her opinion would be of her legacy? What do you think she'd want that to be? And what do you think she would think of all of the, really the fuss and the work that's being done to solve this disappearance case and to sort of bring a finite end to the mystery of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan?
I'm really not sure, Chris. what would she think about all of this? I'm sure she'd find a little bit of humor in it somehow, because we've got all these diverse opinions. I think she was a pragmatic person. I think she'd be a little bit mystified why we are so enthralled by all this.
Tom, this has been great. Any other final thoughts you want to convey on Amelia Earhart, the world flight, on Arona, anything we missed or anything you want to cover before we wrap this interview up?
Sure. I think eventually, because the other major hypotheses have been tested multiple times, and they're failing each test. But all of these tests fail. I think eventually attention will turn to this image, and it, not necessarily so much the Japanese capture hypothesis, but it will turn to this, and I think the Earhart, the Putnam Earhart Air Estate, those people will have to get involved if we're really going to rescue this thing. You know, it's I'm making this a public discovery. They're going to want to have it, if it's, you know, they want to have it investigated correctly, and if it has great value for them, I'm sure that the Marine courts are going to say, you know, this is their property and it belongs to them. And adventurers who think they're going to make a money off of it are wrong. But the estate of the Putnam family would have to work through an aviation museum or something like that to cover the cost. It's going to be enormous cost to investigate it and recover it. You know, it might be the final resting place of Amelia. Who knows? And the family would then, you know, they make a decision whether to go ahead or leave it there as a permanent monument.
Where can listeners find more information about your work and the Arona hypothesis? I know you have a website. We touched on it on the opening of the show. But tell everybody where they can find you online and where they can do more research and really look at the photos more in detail. We're going to have these photos in the show notes, of course, on the website. But where can they find your website, where they can do more research and learn more about the work you've done?
I have a website. It's called AquariusRadar.com. And you go to the homepage of AquariusRadar.com and you will find a link to the Amelia pages. I have three pages dedicated to the theory there.
Tom Maxwell, everyone. Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for sitting in on the podcast and being a guest of Chasing Earhart. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Chris.
I'm Chris Williamson, and you've been listening to the Chasing Earhart podcast. You can follow the project on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the hashtag @ChasingEarhart. You can subscribe to our website at www.chasingearhart.com to get the latest episodes of the show before anyone else, as well as VIP content and advanced tickets to this summer's upcoming Chasing Earhart discussion panel at the Amelia Earhart Festival. If you haven't yet, head to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join me next week as we sit down with project guest and the archivist of the United States, David Ferriero. Thanks for listening.